So this morning we'd like to start with two songs by Swami Kriyananda. And first I should introduce us. We're the L.A. Joy Singers, and we're getting used to our new name. And we're charged with making this music more well-known everywhere in the world, starting with here in L.A. So the music that we're about to sing was composed by Swami Kriyananda. The first song is called Dark Eyes, and it's based on a poem of Master's about the beautiful dark eyes of Divine Mother. And the second song is called O Master, and was written by, actually it's one of the very few that was not written by Swami Kriyananda. The words were written by Swami Kriyananda. Okay, thank you.
Made my heart gay. my slumber and call to me out of the deeps of space. The love that they promise has helped me remember another time, a caring embrace. Another time, a caring
joys fill our days. O Master, may thy wisdom guide our ways. The time has come for us to see that there's but one reality upon the earth and high above. The truth that all was made from love. A love that calls to us to fly above the hills, above the sky, above the storms, above the pain. A land where peace and laughter reign. Thy joy fill our days. O Master, may thy wisdom guide our ways.
Guide all our hopes and all our dreams, past every glow that only seems, into the light, the inner sun, into the truth that we're all one. Help us to find in every hour, in every thought, in every flower, a joy that spans eternity, the truth that makes us ever free. Wisdom guide our ways.
The time has come for us to see that there's but one reality upon the earth and high above, the truth that all was made from love. A love that calls to us to fly above the hills, above the sky, above the storms, above the pain, a land where peace and laughter reign. O Master, may thy joy fill our days. Thy wisdom guide our ways. Guide all our hopes and all our dreams, past every glow that only seems,
into the light, the inner sun, into the truth that we're all one. Help us to find in every hour, in every thought, in every flower, a joy that spans eternity, the truth that makes us ever free. May thy joy fill our days. O Master, may thy wisdom guide our ways. O Master, may thy joy fill our days. O
human ruin as when as when climbing these stairs.
We'd like to invite anyone who wants to sit up front on a cushion. We have a lot of people in the back there. If you want to sit on the floor here, you can please come up. And if you can't see Swamiji, you can slide to the side there. People in front, if they move over for people in the office, that would be great.
I'm very happy to have you all here today for two reasons. One is that tomorrow is the anniversary of Paramahansa Yogananda's passing from this world. And I was there on that occasion, and it's a very poignant one for me. The other reason is that I'm leaving here at the end of this week and going up to Ananda Village. I won't be here for a while. Whether I come back and when is sort of in the air. My real duty has been in Pune, where we're starting a community. And whether I come back to work on a film or not depends on certain factors. But I'm eager to do a film here. I wanted to have my vibrations, and we shall see. But it's been a wonderful time here, and you all have been wonderful people. It's really been very moving to me. There's something about Los Angeles. When Yogananda was crossing the country, he said, my heart calls me to Los Angeles. I feel a draw there. He said, I feel that Los Angeles is the Benares of America. Benares is the holy city of the Jews. Now, why would Los Angeles be that? As far as we know, before we came, it was just a sort of an Indian thing. And after we came, we made a complete mess of it. And it's why it would be the Benares. The fact is that human civilization has been coming and going a long time. And thousands of years ago, this was a very holy center. And there is a prediction that this will be where the next race of man will develop. By race, I don't think they can mean race, but the next wave of consciousness will be centered here. So anyway, this has, I can feel it. When I take a plane and land in Los Angeles with all the restlessness and everything that you find here, I can feel a spiritual vibration. And it's very tangible. It hits you most when you suddenly come in from another one. Anyway, today I want to talk about Yogananda. I lived with him. I'm probably the only person in the world teaching who was trained by him to teach, who spent years learning many things. You know, his mission for me to teach his teachings began when I was 22. I came to him when I was 22. And so it was only 8 months later. I was, I had never spoken before in my life. And I knew that he was scheduled to lecture in San Diego because it was I who had to send in the announcements to the newspapers. He hadn't been to San Diego for at least 2 months. And I thought, oh, those happy people, I wonder if it'll be. Saturday morning, somebody came to my room and said, Master wants you to speak on his behalf in San Diego. I thought, well, this is not possible. I'm only 22. I've never lectured in my life. And I not only had to give the lecture, but to give a Kriya initiation afterwards. I'd already been to one Kriya. Really, it was rather a blow. The best thing for me, though, was that being such a blow, I couldn't think about myself. I was just thinking of those poor people. And when you know, they used to have a curtain on the stage, and the first idea, the first hint that anybody had that I was there instead of Yogananda was when those curtains parted, and there was this me. I was too dramatic a moment to think about myself. I just thought the place was completely packed, people standing in the back, other people looking in the windows, and then I had to talk. It was really a tribute to their years of meditation that nobody left. So anyway, that was my introduction to lecturing, but I've certainly given a lot of talks afterwards. One time Yogananda asked me, is your breath ever silent in meditation, ever quiet? I said, never, sir. He said, that's because you used to talk a lot. So maybe I've talked too much. So I have to get it out of my system. And there's another thing. In past lives, I used to be full of doubts. I was asking questions about everything. And now I think that's helped me. As when you have a broken bone, or the part of the bone that heals is stronger than the bone around it. So when you have a fault and you finally overcome it, that becomes a strength, a virtue. And so my having doubted in the past has made me a good teacher in this life. And I accept that I am a relatively good teacher. Nothing is absolute. But no question that anybody has ever been able to ask me have I found it impossible to answer. I mean, it's easy for me to say, I don't know. I have a few stories I thought to share with you. Before, I'd like to read in my book, The New Path, that experience of his passing. It was a very dramatic occasion. But a few things that are not very much known. For example, when he visited Mahatma Gandhi in India, Yogananda was such a, he was so respectful of everybody. He had, everybody's realities was important to him. And he, Mahatma Gandhi, as you know, was very strong on harmlessness, ahimsa. And Yogananda said to him, well, what if some murderer, a serial killer, were to come to your village and start shooting everybody? What would you do? How would you handle it? And Gandhi said, I would offer myself to be killed first. Well, that's fine, if it works. The chances are it wouldn't work. And then you'd have him there, having killed you, going on and killing everybody else. The fact is that in this world, values are relative. You can't expect them not to be. And so it is necessary sometimes to kill one person rather than allow many people to be killed. But the beautiful thing about Yogananda was that he didn't answer Mahatma Gandhi that way. He didn't argue with him, he just let it go. He would always let the other person have the last word. I found that extremely impressive. When he went Ramana Maharshi, I should say, it was the same story. In the annals of their ashram, you have Swami Yogananda coming and giving he asks a question about, you see, Ramana Maharshi is very much into helping the individual. Yogananda asked something about mass upliftment. Of course, there's a difference between upliftment and enlightenment. Upliftment means that everybody becomes a little better, people become kinder, people become more respectful, all society rises a certain amount. Enlightenment is an entirely different thing. When you become enlightened, you become one with God. So Ramana Maharshi was thinking strictly of that one aspect. And Yogananda asked him, what about mass upliftment? He said, there's no upliftment except enlightenment. Well, that's true, and yet it's not adequate. It's not enough. You have to understand that there is also, if you've got an enlightened society, you're going to find more people seeking enlightenment. And so when an avatar like Yogananda, one of a reincarnated master, comes into this world, he comes to uplift everybody as well as to teach individuals qualitatively. And so Ramana Maharshi said it's not possible. Yogananda let him have the last word. I think that's just a beautiful thing. Yogananda had a broader truth, but he didn't speak of it. One time, Ramana Maharshi's brother, on that occasion, tried to get him into an argument. And Ramana Maharshi saw him and he said, come away. He knew that Master was who Master was. But this sort of either-or thing is something that I would say people of lesser understanding, whereas a great avatar knows that the truth is centered in every human being and must be brought out in every human being. So the either-or consciousness, I was that way. When I began editing Master's work, and that was one of the things he gave me to do, I came on his Rubato Makayam interpretations. He would say, this means so-and-so. Okay, that's what it means. But it also means so-and-so. You know, we've been trained in Aristotelian logic, either or. If a thing is this, it can't be that. And I had a lot of doubts at that time about it. It was many years later, what helped me to overcome those doubts was that I had such love for him. But years later, I went to India, and I found that it was not an either-or attitude, but a both-and. And it's a beautiful attitude. I'll give you a story. When Chaitanya went to Puri, he was a young man and very sweet and full of devotion. Actually, he was a very learned professor, but he didn't show that sign. And Sarvabhauma, a sage, came to him and thought, well, I would like to enlighten you to help you understand things better. So he took one passage of scripture and interpreted it in 25 different ways. And this was a sign of supreme depth of understanding. Quite the opposite of what you and I have been brought up to. And Chaitanya said, that's a marvelous accomplishment. Well done. Let's see if I can think of any more. He came up with another 80. But this way of thinking was so novel to me that it really flabbergasted me. Well, this is where that either-or consciousness, people tend to get into that in both cultures. And it's a limited one. The deeper way is to understand that many, many interpretations are possible of truth. There are many facets to a diamond, and so also to truth. For example, be kind. Well, you can be kind by thinking of the other person. Be kind by thinking that I will be happier if I help the other person. You can be kind by feeling that this will help to raise happiness everywhere. Many different attitudes toward kindness. It's not an absolute. Sometimes, I mean, supposing you've got your little child is just about to step into traffic. You're not going to say, now come back, Johnny. You might get run over. You're going to yank him back and maybe smack him on the bottom a little bit. And this is kindness, but the little child won't know that at the time. So how many interpretations? But the one thing that I marveled at was how respectful. Here was this great teacher, and yet he was so respectful of everyone. One time there was a discussion that he got into with some preacher, and he was trying to say that not everything in the Bible can be taken literally. For example, in the Garden of Eden, you have a serpent speaking. How could that be? The man answered, in those days, serpents could speak. What are you going to do with that one? So Master just said, he took his hat off and bowed. He said, I bow to the colossal temple of ignorance that I behold before me. When I met Master, I had never met such a great man in my life. And yet, somehow, he always represents to me not a human being, but a principle that all of us could live. I would look into his eyes, and I would see just space there. I would see no ego. There was no sense of reaction. If you said something, it's not that he was pleased or displeased. He just, what he did was react back to you, your own higher self. An interesting thing was two photographs that I've seen. One of him with Portes Gil, who was the president of Mexico. And he not only had the name Portes, but he was portly. And sort of a stout, big fellow. And Master looked portly. But then, I mean, all right, you could say, okay, he's portly. Then he was next to Amanita Galli-Curci, who was a famous Italian soprano. And she was little and frail and thin. And in some way, he looked like her. And the wonderful thing is that he reflected back whatever his environment was. He told a story of Krishna. An artist tried to capture Krishna. And Krishna's face kept changing. And finally, the artist said, I have you now. So he got a mirror and held it up to Krishna. As many times as Krishna changed, the image in the mirror changed. But really, I could never remember what Master looked like. I had to look at a photograph. I'd mix with him daily, and still I couldn't remember. But I do remember the vibrations that came from him, the absolute thrill. That I remember one time I was leaving the room. I used to be very nearsighted. It isn't that as you grow older, your eyes become better. It's rather that I've had an operation, and because of that, I can see better. But in those days, I couldn't see, and I couldn't see your expression. And it's really become an embarrassment for everybody that I can see them now. But I couldn't see his expression. It was waves of love that just, honestly, I just, tears fell down my cheeks. And I remember another time, a difficulty I had with him was that in a group of people, he always singled me out to talk to him. And I found it disconcerting because I wanted to close my eyes and just feel his vibrations, but he always talked to me. So one time, he was talking to a group of people, not to me. They were talking about, I don't know what's happened to Los Angeles. It seems to have failed in one basic respect. This used to be a season of heavy rains, and now it's been beautiful weather. But they'd had heavy rains at Mount Washington, potholes everywhere. So Master was talking to them about filling in these potholes. And so he wasn't looking at me, he was looking at the workers. And I wouldn't be doing that because I was doing another work. So I could just close my eyes and I just, waves of bliss, I can't tell you. You have to have been with a master to know. I never saw him from a worldly point of view. I saw him from the heights. He was an expression of bliss. He was an incarnation of bliss. This is my opinion. And everything he did, there was a sort of an undertow of bliss. But there are some beautiful stories connected with that too. For example, one time he was coming down a street in Los Angeles. He said, stop the car. And he walked back a few doors. He went into a variety shop. And a disciple who told me the story said, I just wondered what he was doing, buying that junk. He went around buying, selecting things that were just junk. And he thought, he'll never use those things. And he came to the front desk, and when the lady saw it all, she just was starting to light up. And she added it up, and she looked extremely hopeful. And when he paid her the money, she just burst into tears. And she said, I very badly needed just this sum of money today. And the show's time, closing time is approaching. I didn't know how I would get it. But God must have sent you to this shop today. And Yogananda didn't say anything. He just got in the car and went away. But he never spoke about miracles. He just performed them. But I remember one time we were working on plastering a building. And the plaster that day was old plaster, and it was setting up very fast. I had to keep playing with water to keep it soft enough to get it onto the building. And just as I'd poured a new hot of mud, as we used to say, onto the board, Yogananda drove by in his car and called us. He stopped us, stopped the car, and called us over to him. And he held us there for about half an hour. We were, of course, happy to be with him, but we couldn't help thinking in the back of our minds that we'd have to take a sledgehammer to that plaster. And we didn't allow that to make us wish we weren't with him. But when we got back to the board, we thought, now is the big test. You know, that mud was soft. It remained fresh and soft all the rest of the day. And this is just typical of the way things are worked around him. I remember one time I was at a bar mitzvah. I was demonstrating yoga postures there. I'm not Jewish, and I don't even know what bar mitzvah means exactly, but I was at one. And I had to perform these postures, but afterwards a very worldly, atheistical kind of psychiatrist approached me, and he tried to get me in a corner with all this nonsense of yogis and stuff. And I tried to convince him, and so I suggested to him that I told him about certain miracles that I had seen. And I could see him thinking, well, 11 o'clock on Wednesday, I can see this patient. And I saw Yogananda 2 days later, and I used to serve lunch for his guests when they came. And then after they left, he would sit with me and I would talk with him. And he said to me that day, by the way, when you're with atheists and materialistic people, he said, don't talk about miracles. I said, you knew. He said, I know every thought you think. And he showed it many times. One time there was a boy on the highway coming from Phoenix to see him. And he was very hungry, and he wanted to go into a restaurant. Finally, he found one that was open. He went in. All they had was hamburger. Well, of course, we're vegetarian. And so hamburgers are really not allowed, so to speak. And this boy thought, oh, well, he won't know. So he had a couple of hamburgers. And when Yogananda saw him again, he didn't scold, he didn't say anything, really. But at the end of the conversation, he just casually mentioned, by the way, when you're on the highway late at night and you come to a restaurant that serves only hamburgers, better not eat anything. And another occasion, two of the young monks were going down to Encinitas to see him. And they were talking about unmonastic things. I'll leave you to imagine what they might have been. Yogananda met them at the front gate, and he quoted to them everything they said. And he said, if you're here for God, forget those things. And I said, yes, sir. But really the payoff was, one time there was a member of our church in Hollywood, and he was not a sincere person. And we were talking a little bit, and I told him I would be giving the class on Wednesday. And he said, oh, I'll be sure to be there then. And I knew that he wasn't sincere. He would have been there anyway. He was just flattering me. So I didn't want to accept that flattery. And I said to him, in that case, would you please check people's pockets for vegetables? And when Yogananda, when I saw him again at the luncheon table, he said to me, by the way, when you're with congregation members, don't talk of vegetables. And he said it isn't dignified. Well, in these ways, it was awesome to be with him. I was happy that he knew my every thought. There was nothing I wanted to hide from him. And I had come there for learning. But it was such a wonderful thing to have somebody who could always be there. If I had some subtle mistake in my meditation, one time I used to pray to him for a while, teach me to love you as you love me. And he looked at me one day. He said, how can the wave embrace the whole ocean? In other words, he was the ocean. I was a little wave. How could I have that same love? So in these ways also he corrected our meditations. It was a wonderful thing. Living with him was the most inspiring experience in my life. But the power that he had was unbelievable. Well, there's a story that Mr. Black, he said to us that in realization, the most fully realized is Rajashi. St. Lenny is the word then. Then Mr. Oliver Black, and then Sister Kalamata. And Oliver Black was visiting. You know, miracles of this nature, masters perform only to people who have high realization. And so Mr. Black was in Encinitas, and it was a very, very heavily rainy day. And Mr. Black received the word that Master wanted him to go out with him for a drive. And Mr. Black, seeing all this rain, was thinking, we won't even be able to look out the window. It's raining so heavily. And so he left his room to go to the front steps, just a matter of a few feet. When he got out of doors, the sky was blue. The ground was dry. That's the unbelievable part. Everything was completely as if it hadn't rained at all. And Master looked at him with a little quiet smile. He said, "For you, Oliver." Well, it's what did he do? It's as if he sort of changed the dream. Amazing. He raised people from the dead. His most important miracle was to give that consciousness of bliss to other people. His ability to forgive was absolute. One time he was scolding a disciple, and the disciple said, "But Master, you will forgive me, won't you?" And Master looked a little astonished. He said, "Well, what else can I do?" He couldn't hold a grudge. There was no sense of I to hold a grudge. But he was so kind and so considerate. And even when he scolded people, and he did, because after all he was teaching us, it was always with love. There was one time up on the third floor interview room, there was a nun on a couch at one end of the room and a monk on a chair at the other end of the room. And Master was scolding this nun. And this monk told me, "You'd have thought the roof would fly off." He was really giving it to her. But every time he turned his back to her, he looked at the monk and sort of winked a little and then turned back like this. But it was all an act. He had to do it. He wanted to really impress it, like that little child going into traffic. One thing that people don't realize, he was not a scholar. But my gosh, it was amazing to me that he knew every current in Christian thought. And he had much of his teachings addressed those currents. Some school of heresy or whatever it might be in different phases of Christian history, he knew it all. His teachings were a marvelous blend of all the great masters and all their teachings down through the centuries. He taught how, well, one thing, Shankaracharya. Okay, first of all, there came Buddha. And Buddha arrived on the scene when people were doing what they knew as karmakanda, doing actions to get better karma, doing actions to have the gods be pleased and give you a boon of a good wife or a good husband or victory in battle or fame or whatever you want. And people began to be dependent upon the gods doing things for them. Buddha said, "This is absolute nonsense. It's not going to get you what you're looking for, which is enlightenment." And he said that you must understand that self-effort is essential. Well, there are two things essential on the path. One is grace, yes. Everything is grace in the last analysis. You have the sunlight on a building. And it's the sunlight who gives the light. But you can keep the curtains of your bedroom closed. You have to open those curtains. And when you do, then the sunlight can come in. So that's the part of self-effort on the path. You can't do it for yourself, but you have to open yourself to that grace. And Buddha was talking about the need to open yourself. Well, his followers took the message because he didn't talk about God. He talked about what you can do. The masters don't come with absolute messages. They come with messages for the times that, for the needs that people have. People stray too far to the right, they say go left. Too far to the left, they say go right. If the goal of progress were to reach the equator, people in the northern hemisphere would be told to go south. People in the southern hemisphere would be told to go north. Now, as human nature being what it is, they'd continue. They'd reach the equator and keep going. And so those coming from the north invading the south would be encountering all these people in the south who would say, no, you're supposed to go north. No, south. And so you get all the fighting and religion that you hear. But it's all a myth. It's ridiculous. Anyway, Buddha came, but his followers thought he was an atheist. He couldn't have been an atheist, and he wasn't. But in fact, the nirvana that he preached is that state, and it's a real state. When you have completely overcome all of every ripple of desire, every ripple of self-definition, there's a moment of absolute emptiness. Then, if you accept that emptiness, then into that emptiness pours the great bliss of infinite, the oceanic bliss of the infinite. So you go beyond nirvana to samadhi. Well, I read a tract in Thailand in 1958 in which it was comparing the bliss of Shankaracharya with the nirvana of Buddha. And they were saying that it's true that you have a little bit of bliss and then it's nothing. Well, I must say, I don't see Buddhas working all that hard to achieve nothingness. Who would? Well, there's always the wish to become a bodhisattva, which is to say to sort of be almost free and then help other people. But who's going to work to become nothing? Your ego becomes nothing. You don't become nothing. Then you find that there's something more behind it. So this teaching was a mistake. But Shankaracharya was born to correct that mistake. And Shankaracharya explained that God is not Shiva, Parvati, Kali, Uma, all those different forms. People speak of the Indians as being idol worshippers. This is wrong. They are ideal worshippers. That's what they are. And each picture, each image represents an ideal. It's very different. Anyway, he said that God is not those, but he does exist. And he is Satchitananda. And Yogananda translated this. Usually they just translate existence, consciousness, bliss. Big deal. It doesn't make you feel like doing anything about it. But Yogananda explained it as ever conscious, ever existing, ever new bliss. And Yogananda added that word, ever new. It's absolutely thrilling to realize that every human being will express bliss in his own way. This bliss is an infinite thing. It's not as if you finally reach there and say, bliss again this morning. Every second is thrilling. You'll experience it a different way from I. From me. Me. Gosh. I'm a stickler for these things here. I can't remember which is right. Anyway, From me. Yes, from me, right? Forgive me. This is my sickness. And so this bliss is something absolutely... Everyone experiences it different. Every second is a different experience. And through eternity, it's just, as Yogananda said, beyond imagination of expectancy. The thrill of knowing God is far, far beyond anything you can even imagine. Well, then, however, Shankaracharya was saying it's all a dream. So people began thinking of that dream very intellectually. They didn't take into account that Shankara himself had written a whole book of poetry and prayers to the Divine Mother. And so it became too dry. His followers became dry. And so Ramanuja came on the scene. And Ramanuja said, yes, everything is a dream of God's, but each soul is specific. You're going to explain it this way. When you merge in God, you become one with him, you lose your ego, but you always have that memory in omniscience that you were yourself. You never lose that. You become one with it, and yet you remember that you had lived through this specific sequence. And so Ramanuja was right also. All of them are right. It's a matter of interpretation and custom. And then Chaitanya came and said, you've got to own it. He said, Harir Nam, Harir Nam, Harir Nam, Kevalam. Only by God's name, God's name, God's name can you find God. He was right. But he didn't tell the whole truth. It wasn't ready. People weren't ready. God's name means Om. You can only find God through, God doesn't have a name unless it be Om. But in deep meditation, you have to go into Om. And when you merge in that vibration, you attain Om Samadhi. Then you find the Christ consciousness there in every atom. Then you go beyond that to the spirit. I'm not going to go into that philosophy deeply. But I just want to show how wonderful it was that Yogananda explained all these things as they've never been explained before in a very clear way. I think that's one reason he came to America. Americans are not just materialistic. There's a very real spiritual hunger here. And apart from that, they're very down to earth. They like things that you can see and feel. And so it was necessary for him to explain these things exactly. Where in other cultures, in India, they didn't have to be that exact. So he was very careful to explain everything, every Christian dogma and trauma that they've gone through, every Indian change in teachings. He showed how those who were right were right. When they were wrong, he showed that they were wrong. But I was so impressed that he made everything so clear. I think I needed that myself. But being with him, I began to, when he wrote his Bhagavad Gita interpretations, it was thrilling. I said, this is the best book I've ever read. But in addition to that, he was so, cosmic in his love. And his consciousness. He would walk around the enclosure there at 29 Palms with me. And he would have to sort of lean on me because he'd had difficulty with his knees. Masters will often take the karma of their disciples. And sometimes he would almost fall, and I'd have to hold him. And he said one time, it's so difficult for me to remember which body I'm supposed to keep moving. I'm in all bodies. Well, he certainly demonstrated that to me. He knew every thought that I had. And one time I had a very strange experience. I had heard, when I was new on the path, I mean new, emphasized, bold-faced, capital letters. Anything else you want to make it? I didn't know anything. I had not believed in God until just a short time before. And once I did, I really was gung-ho for it. But the what was I saying?
Something strange happened to you?
Yeah, thank you. One thing that I couldn't, that was totally new to me was the thought of possession. When I read this in the Bible about people being possessed, I thought, well, gosh, that doesn't make any sense at all. And so I wanted to have an experience of it to see if it really was true. So one night I had a dream. And in this dream I was at a party. And suddenly I thought in my dream, it's time for me to go and face a disincarnate spirit. So I left that room and entered a room with bare floorboards. I can still see that room. And I stood in the middle of the room and I said, all right, come on, show me what this is all about. It possessed me. Essentially, I was asking. And suddenly I felt myself sort of floating around and nothing specific about my body. I felt myself being sucked out the window, and I tried to fight back, and I wasn't sure I'd succeed. So I finally said, Master! Instantly the thing stopped. And I asked him about it later. He said, yes, it's true. These things can happen on the path. Don't worry about it. But then he asked me a few more questions. Well, I had asked him. I had called to him. I assumed he knew what he was talking about. And I said, well, didn't you know? He was asking about the experience and what it was and so on. And I said, didn't you know? Very impatiently, he just answered, when you're one with God, you are God. And just as if, how could you be so stupid as not to understand that? Well, that's quite a statement, isn't it? And yet it's the truth. That's the state you have to reach. You will be God. I don't say that your body will be God or your ego will be God, but your soul will become one with him. And in that oneness, that is what you become. And when you're a great master like that, that is what you know yourself to be. This is a fantastic path we're on. Everybody is on the same path. Whether they know it or not, that everybody in the world is on this path. This is what everyone is seeking, but they don't know it. And so what everybody is seeking is a pale substitute. They want to avoid pain and find happiness. But behind that happiness, that desire for happiness, is the latent, I should say, desire for bliss. And when you've gone into your superconscious state, that's where you go. So, Master, well, it's a little late here. I should read. I could go on forever. I would like to read the last day when Master left his body. I have a big day tomorrow, he said the day before. Walking toward the elevator, he paused at the door, then repeated, I have a big day tomorrow. Wish me luck. The following day, March 7th, he came downstairs to go out. He was scheduled to attend a banquet that evening at the Biltmore Hotel in honor of the Indian ambassador, Binay Ashim. Imagine, he said, I've taken a room at the Biltmore. That's where I first started in this city. Then again, he repeated, wish me luck. Master had asked me to attend the banquet with Dick Hames, the popular singer and movie actor. Dick had recently become a disciple and had taken Kriya initiation from me. Years ago, Master had said, when I leave this earth, I want to go speaking of my America and my India. And in a song about India that he had written, to the tune of the popular song, My California. He paraphrased the original ending with the words, I know when I die, in joy I will sigh for my sunny, grand old India. Once too in a lecture he had stated, a heart attack is the easiest way to go. That is how I choose to die. This evening, all these predictions were to prove true. Master was scheduled to speak after the banquet. His brief talk was so sweet, so almost tender, that I think everyone present felt embraced in the gossamer net of his love. Warmly he spoke of India and America and of their respective contributions to world peace and true human progress. He talked of their future cooperation. Finally, he read his beautiful poem, My India. Throughout his speech, I was busy recording his words, keeping my eyes on the notebook. He came to the last lines of the poem, where Ganges, woods, Himalayan caves, and men dream God. I am hallowed. My body touched that sound. Sod became a long drawn out sigh. Suddenly, from all sides of the room, there came a loud cry. I looked up. What is it? I demanded of Dick Ames, seated beside me. What happened? Master fainted, he replied. Oh, no, Master, you wouldn't faint. You've left us. You've left us? The forgotten playwright in me cried silently. This is too perfect a way for you to go, for it to mean anything else. I hastened to where Master lay. A look of bliss was on his face. Virginia Wright was stooped over him, trying desperately to revive him. Mr. Ahuja, the Consul General, came over to me and put an arm around my shoulders to comfort me. Never, dear friend, will I forget that sweet act of kindness. They brought Master's body to Mount Washington and placed it lovingly on his bed. One by one we went in, weeping, and knelt by his bedside. Mother, cried Joseph, oh, mother. Indeed, Master had been a mother to us all. Ah, and how much more than a mother. Miss Lancaster gave me an anguished look. How many thousands of years it took, marveled Laurie Pratt, gazing upon him in quiet awe, to produce such a perfect face. Later on, after we'd left the room, Fay remained alone with Master's body. As she gazed at him, a tear formed on his left eyelid and slowly trickled down his cheek. Lovingly, she caught it with her handkerchief. She would always preserve it. In death as in life, he was telling his beloved disciple, and through her, the rest of us, I love you always, through endless cycles of time, unconditionally, without any desire except for your happiness forever in God. And so we've had the custom, and I'm of two minds on that one, of asking people if they have questions. I would like to say it this way. Today, let those questions be about Yogananda. Yeah. I may not hear you, so just let well till he gets up here.
Is Master ever lucky to take another body?
I didn't hear.
Will Master ever take another body?
He said he would come back, if need be, a trillion times, as long as one stray brother sits weeping by the wayside. He said his next life he would come back. He would live in the Himalayas. it would be in 200 years. And sometimes people say he's come back and so on. No, 200 years is what he said. Yes.
Was Yogananda aware of other masters in India? Did he have any contact with them? And what was his perception of his place among all the masters?
He wrote an autobiography of a yogi. Have you read it? Well, he talks of many in that book. So I wonder how you can ask that question. He certainly knew them. And his place among them, I just don't know how to answer that question. He didn't compare, really. All are saints. Okay. Where are you from?
Malaysia.
Malaysia.
My question is, you spoke that Yogananda took on a lot of karma for his disciples. At some point, was there any point where he stopped doing that or not advised to do that because of his body or age or anything like that?
You'll have to help me.
You said that Yogananda took on a lot of karma for his disciples. Was there any point because of age or anything else at which he stopped doing that?
He didn't die very old. He died at 59.
As his body got more infirm or whatever.
You know, his body is incorrupt. I couldn't call it infirm.
Is at some point not to take on the karma because it would be a better lesson for that individual? I mean, what made him want to take it on or choose not to?
Did he choose at any time not to take on karma because it would be better for that individual?
I'm sure he did. He certainly didn't take away all my karma. These are subtle things, and I really can't give an absolute answer. But on the other hand, they do take on... This becomes a very interesting question when you consider that Christians believe that Jesus' crucifixion took the karma of the whole world, saved the whole world. First of all, you have to look at the world. Don't look at the crucifixion, look at the world. Did it become better? In fact, it became worse. You sank from the time of Jesus into the Roman games and the horrible experiences. So he did not take the karma of the world. He took the karma of his disciples, and that's what masters do. How much karma? Well, I said to him one time, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? He says, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. If he had taken all my karma, it would not have been that long time. We have to do the work. They help us along. How much they help us, we can't say. But... It's a subtle subject.
Hi. First of all, thank you for this tender presentation. It was really wonderful.
What's that?
She wanted to thank you for this. She said it's been really wonderful.
I'm glad.
Okay.
Thank you.
My question is, when Yogananda initiated people into Kriya Yoga, did he require for them to now devote their services to him, or could they, let's say, stay with Babaji or Christ?
He said that it would be any one of the gurus. But mind you, there's another thing that SRF has made a dogma of this. It's beyond what he said. Larry Marsh, I gave it freely to everybody. Yogananda wanted people to become members because he knew that in this country they didn't understand these things properly. But he made a very strong point at one initiation that I attended. There was somebody there from another organization whose loyalty was to that organization. And he made a very strong point during the initiation of saying that it isn't a question really of which path you're on. You can be on another path as long as you're seriously committed to seeking God.
And this is also still true today. That's when right. Initiation
this is into also true today.
It's true at Ananda, it's not true in SRF.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you? It is such a pleasure to see you. I have been reading your recounting of the explanations of the Bhagavad Gita that Paramhansa gave to you, and I must say I enjoy it so much. It means so much to me. Yeah. I want to thank you for that. And I was wondering, I just wanted to ask you anything. I just want to speak to you. I've admired your writings for a long time and read the autobiography in the early 70s, and it set me and many of my friends, you know, into the exploration of consciousness, and we have enjoyed it. It has enhanced my life throughout. I want to thank you for that, but I just wonder as to Paramhansa's use of the Bhagavad Gita. Did he speak of it frequently? Did he use it in his daily teachings?
All the time.
All the time.
Yes.
Thank you.
His main mission was to show the underlying unity between the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita.
Thank you for that. You don't know. That means so much to me. I wonder, before I leave, can I get an autograph of my copy? It's dog-eared.
Okay.
I would love to have it autographed by you. And
I won't scoot out the door.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Besides which, I want to greet my old friend Vijay here.
When Yoganandaji passed through transition, was there any disease involved, or did he just stay healthy?
He had a heart condition.
Or did he just stay healthy and leave his body because it was his time?
What was that?
Did he have an illness, or did he stay healthy and then just leave his body?
That's right, but it was a heart. He died of a heart failure, but, you know, at that convenient moment for him to leave his body, he finished the poem. Everything was exactly, a dramatist would say, it's just as perfect as it could be. And it was completely under his will. It wasn't forced upon him. Yeah.
Swamiji, it's been so wonderful to have you in Los Angeles for the last several months. And sometimes you will speak in Yogananda's voice and say some of his the things that he would say that touched you. And I was wondering if you could share a few of those
Well, when he gave his talk, but I must say this is an unusual occasion because in my whole life I have never heard such a powerful speech. He was talking at the Myers Garden Party in Beverly Hills, and he was talking about the need for communities. He said, "This day marks the beginning of a new era." Well, I won't go on, but it was. The most powerful speech I ever heard. Any other questions? Yes. The man there?
Hello, Swamiji. I'm here. Hi, Swamiji.
Okay,
I just wanted to ask you, first of all, I hope, are you feeling well? You said you were not sleeping. Did you get some sleep?
Are you feeling well?
Yeah, sort of. Today I'm not great.
Okay.
Well, this week has been sort of a difficult week. Sunday night, no sleep at all. Monday night, maximum 1.5 hours. Tuesday night, 4 hours. Wednesday night, no sleep at all. So this has been sort of a record for me, but I'm doing pretty well.
Okay. And we are so fortunate to have you here. We wanted to thank you for that.
It's been my joy.
And I do have a question. The question is, what do people do, like families like us, with children and so many duties and spouses? How can we love and serve God more?
You know, I loved an answer that Ramakrishna gave to one woman. He said, think of your son, your little son, as Balakrishna. So think of the children as manifestations of God. Treat them with that kind of love and reverence. And you can find him that way. You know, a woman who marries and has children, she has to give up 20 years of her life, if you think of it that way, or more. But if she thinks that this is her devotion, then it, actually you can, if you do your duty, and this is of course a duty, then you advance more quickly. Doing your duty in life is the way to advance. And the fact that somebody has another duty doesn't matter. Your duty is this. So it's a blessing. It's a blessing to be able to bring children into the world in such a way that they can be inspired spiritually. It's a risk, it's difficult, all sorts of things, but this is true also. Yes?
Thank you so much for bringing Yogananda's presence to us through you. It's just a joy. Since Yogananda's presence on earth was such a blessing to so many, do you feel, as far as you know, that he felt like his work was completed? Because it seems like, from a mental sense, it would benefit the world for him to stay longer.
You know, it's awkward for me to say this, but let me say that when he was William the Conqueror, his oldest son betrayed him. His second son just didn't think about it as being a mission at all. It was his third son who took up the mission and completed it. When he was, I think he was, Fernando III, he didn't say so, but it all adds up. His son Alfonso completed that mission. It's very difficult for one man to complete a mission. Now, in this case, a mission like that usually requires male energy. The male, even the sex organs are outside as opposed to inside. Male energy goes out. Male energy can promulgate. Feminine energy is more inward. And I know Master, he told me several times already that I had a great work to do. And at the desert one time, we were alone, and he said, apart from St. Lynn, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me. And he spoke with great power. I see that I am the only disciple who has written about him, written books about him, written about my life with him, what it was like to be with him, who has tried to express his teachings in ways that will reach people, has completed his ideal of having schools, has completed his ideal of having communities. I'm the only one. So I can only think, and forgive me if this seems like arrogance, I don't feel proud of it at all, but I do feel it's true and a cause of great blessing for me that I've had to been, it's been my job to complete that mission. Is the mission completed? Will it ever be completed? That's another dimension of the question. But his actual beginning things, many things he tried to do and couldn't do because people weren't ready, like starting communities, I have been able to do. And I have 8 communities and we have some 1,000 people living in them. So that plus his words, it leads to that in my mind. I feel awkward saying it, but I think that's the truth. Any other question? Yes.
Thank Thank you, Master, for allowing us, for you to be so kind to share what you share with us. And it's always not enough.
Is it?
She's thanking you for you sharing.
Oh, thank you.
But it's but it's never not enough. So I have to. I'd like to go back to the question about kriya. When the master in his book, and he was going out to wherever he was going out to prove to his brother that he didn't need money, and then he came back with money, and his brother then believed him. You remember that?
The two penniless boys in Vrindavan.
Oh, yes.
And so the last person to give him money was a young man who wanted kriya. And so he didn't require like a lot of preparation or of a year or anything like that. So
he saw that he was ready. Mind you, this man had had a vision of Krishna showing him that his guru was there. This man was ready for it.
So
the more interesting question is, was his brother ready for it? Because he gave him, after he got back to Agra, he gave kriya to his brother.
Oh. But, so my question is, today, is that possible? A person doesn't have to go through all that.
Is it possible today for someone to see spontaneously, or see
not go through all the steps required?
I think probably, yeah. The main thing is that you become ready by becoming enough interiorized. Kriya is bringing the energy in the spine. And if you can live within yourself, in your center, then that's good. If your mind is all out here, you're not ready for kriya. So that's what makes you ready. When you show that you're centered enough to get your energy into the spine. Not a question of upward sincerity, inward sincerity. Okay?
Thank you, because then I'll work more on it. Yes. Thank you.
Swamiji, there's a question from Kate online. She's asking if Yogananda ever visited spots in nature in Los Angeles, like the beach or the mountains.
Kate online is asking if Master ever visited spots in nature in Los Angeles, the beach or the mountains.
Yes, he did. Did he go to Yosemite, I wonder? I don't know. But he did go. We went sightseeing. Okay? Yes.
Did Yogananda have an opinion of having his picture taken? Did he enjoy having his photograph taken of it?
Did Yogananda enjoy having his photograph taken?
I think he enjoyed himself and everything he enjoyed. So it's not that he rebelled at it against it. He was willing. I remember one photograph, somebody asked him if he could take his photo. And Matt says, just a moment, I'll go into Samadhi. All right. Just like that, well, I mean. Yes.
Question.
Sorry.
Hear me? How would Master answer the question, is Kutasha the guru?
How would Master answer the question, is the Kutasha the guru?
I would say that's an intriguing point. It's the guru in that this is what leads you upward. It's the light that leads you. The guru is the outward. But you can't get there just by the Kutasha. You need the human help. The reason for having a guru is that, as it says in the Bible, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. This receiving, we have to get out of the ego if we were to find oneness with God. And that effort of getting out of the ego is very difficult. It's not enough to be humble. I don't mean pride when I say ego. I mean this thought that this is my center, when my center isn't everybody. That is not easy. You can only, the ego is already, you might say, it's already caught the disease. How does it cure itself? It can't. There was like that story that I've told of a man who was being bothered by a demon. This is a story Master told me. And he read in the Shastras, the scriptures, that you, if you say a certain mantra and cast some powder onto that, it'll vanish. But he did this with the demon and threw the powder on the demon. And the demon laughed at him. He said, before you could even get even say your mantra, I myself got into the mantra and the rice that you were throwing. And so what Master was saying with that was, the ego by itself cannot get out of itself. It has, you have to have the help of somebody who's out of it. And by attunement with that, you begin to understand that is my reality. People don't understand that a guru is not there to correct your personality. There are all kinds of personalities. Saints are a strange bunch of people. But they're all blissful, they're all loving, they're all humble, they all... But each one is himself, and each one is different. So the beautiful thing is that that uniqueness is your inner self, and you are unique. Each one of us is unique. Each one of us experiences bliss uniquely. But at the same time, that that ego is what blocks you from it. Your ego is really imitative. You get born in an American body, you think like an American, act like an American, and so on. So the main thing is attunement with that. Well, two aspects are involved here. One is your attempt to attune with it. The other is his attempt to reach out and bring you in. And the more you're willing to come along, the easier it is. So, but the Kutastha is really, as I said earlier, to me, Master was not just a person, he was a principle. And this is the principle, the inner light. And when you merge in that inner light, that is what draws you finally. But it needs a human vehicle. And that's where the Kutastha can't do it.
Somebody to turn on the lamp.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Yes. Finally get your chance.
Thank you. And did... A lot of people have described Kriya Yoga as most effective or using a lot of superlatives. Did Master ever, in his admiration for all paths, did Master ever say that Kriya Yoga was the most effective device for salvation? Or is that simply what other
people... That's what he said.
He did say that.
Yes. And why is it? Well, other ways are byways, but the big thing is to get into the spine. This is where enlightenment takes place. You get centered in your spine, you raise the energy in the spine. It isn't as if you can say, well, I'm a Muslim and I'd rather, I sort of think it comes out the arms. Everybody, it has to go up the spine. And that's what Kriya does. Mind you, there are the techniques that do that. It's been taught down through the ages. Master said Jesus taught it. There's a tradition in Spain that when Jesus died, he did, and that's exactly the mudra that the Kriya Yogi uses to go into, go out of the body.
Thank you. So others can have this realization because, in other words, Kriya Yoga is not exclusive. There are other techniques that can put you in touch internally.
They do. But this is puts you in touch directly with the path you have to take, which is universal. And you can't say, because I'm Jewish, I don't do that. Everybody has to do that. Even if they don't know what they're doing, if grace descends, that's how it happens.
Could you clarify this universal path?
What's that again?
You said a universal path.
Can you clarify the term universal path?
There are 6 billion people in the world. It's true for all of them.
Yeah. Okay.
Swami, I remember reading in Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, that Sri Yukteswar had a problem and denigrated Yogananda in front of his father, for which he apologized later. Did Yogananda himself ever say that he made a mistake?
I didn't get that.
He was saying that Sri Yukteswar ended up apologizing for denigrating Master in front of his father. Then he went on to ask, did Yogananda ever say that he himself had made a mistake?
I'm not sure. He would certainly be ready to. It was absolutely no problem for him. But I do believe that there was some occasion, but it doesn't come to mind now. But any master is free from ego. Why would he hesitate to say I'm wrong if he sees I'm wrong? They may be right in one respect, but wrong in another. It's not an issue with them. Really, Master may have spoken of it as Sri Yukteswar's humility, but it was a natural thing. Do you praise a rose blossom for being sweet smelling? It just is. So anyway, that's the best answer I can give you on that one. Well, I think that things have gone on long enough here. I will be giving the talk on the class on Tuesday, and then I won't be here. I'll be doing a radio interview on Thursday, then Friday I vanish into the unknown. But I hope you'll join me in that unknown. It's not that far away.